Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have in the studio, on the right, Senator Dan McKay.
Hey, everybody.
Dan, nice to have you in the studio again. And on the left, we have Emily Hayes, the chair of the Salt Lake County Democrats.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you again, Emily. It's been a fast-paced week, and I want to start right with the Democratic debates that have happened this week. 12 candidates up on the stage. Wow, it was quite a sight.
There was a lot of people on that stage. It was a little overwhelming.
I believe
it was the largest debate ever to happen with that many people on stage. Interesting that it happened this year.
I watched it with interest and will just say that I have a lot of opinions about it. To me, I'll do the stars and we can kind of break it down. But for me, I really thought that Amy Klobuchar and Andrew Yang did a really nice job.
Yeah.
So let's go, Emily, since it's your party, and then we'll let Dan kind of give his who the stars were and initial reactions.
Yeah, well, I think my biggest takeaway that it was pretty clear who the field thinks is now the front runner, with a lot of attention going to Elizabeth Warren. She was pushed on a lot of her platform, a lot of her issues, a lot of attacks came her way. And I think it was also pretty clear who's vying now for the moderate vote. Mm-hmm. Now that I think a lot of candidates are seeing some weaknesses in Joe Biden. As you said, Amy Klobuchar was really strong last night. I think it was her strongest debate. She was definitely more kind of on the attack mode.
I think she did a really nice job.
Yeah, she did a really good job of stating what her values are and differentiating herself. And then I think Pete Buttigieg also did a really good job of kind of stepping in to fill that moderate space that Joe Biden might be vacating at this point. It's hard to know. He didn't have the strongest performance the last couple debates. And with all of this Ukraine business going on, he hasn't responded in a way that I think a lot of people are responding well to. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that in the field.
I said to my husband, he worked late when he got home. I had watched the debate and I said, Biden's done. That's what I told him. But
oh, wow.
Just my sense. I mean, I'm just watching this talent on the stage, and mm-hmm. Biden didn't make a compelling argument for the middle.
Yeah,
which is what he's supposed to kind of represent. And I thought Amy and Andrew Yang had that. I should say Senator Klobuchar and Andrew Yang. Dan, your initial reactions and who were the winners or losers?
Well, the winners is the Republican Party. The losers is the Democratic Party. And honestly, every time you watch like highlights from these debates or you listen to just the after debate spin of what was said, what won't be said, and how they're going to go, I tell you, it just gets stranger constantly.
Have you seen your president? Have you watched him on TV recently?
Just check in. We're talking about the debate here. Let's not lose focus. At the end of the day, it is like, hey, we have got to find crazy to defeat crazy. And it seems like, right? From the Democratic mantra, they are just going to double down on every bad policy idea that excluded Hillary Clinton from the base last time and pushed everybody over to Donald Trump's camp. And they're doubling down on all those policies. And honestly, it's not getting better. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought the most rational comment of all of the debate platform was Tulsi Gabbard, House Representative from Hawaii. And she talked about, I think if Democrats were to run to the middle of their base, they would follow her example and her example, especially the abortion issue came up. And Tulsi Gabbard's, Representative Gabbard's response was, hey, abortions should be rare and they should be safe. Let's stick to those two things. And that was her thing. If she ran in that direction and the party followed her, I think Donald Trump would have trouble.
Interesting.
But if they doubled down on this kind of stuff that they were talking about, that whole debate field was a bag of cats.
Dan, you're going to a social issue. I was just struck by the economic issues. And I have my phone out because I kind of made a list of these. But we had Medicare for all, free public college, free universal child care, eliminating most Americans' college debt, a federal jobs guarantee, larger Social Security benefits, I'm not done yet, a doubling of the minimum wage, and universal basic income. I look at that, Emily, and I'm just sort of like, do they not understand how taxes and government expenditures affect the private economy? Just your reaction.
I think Democrats...
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, I just sort of like, really?
Well, I think the reality is that Democrats realize that in order to provide a society in which everyone can thrive, we have to taxes are a reality in this world. I pay taxes. Mm-hmm. I've paid taxes since I was 14 years old when I got my first job. And I think that we realize that by supporting other people through this kind of social benefit, we can create a society in which we can all be successful. Mm-hmm. Now, can we do every single one of those social policy ideas? Obviously not. Like, mm-hmm.
We got a $1 trillion deficit this year.
We do. And a lot of that's because the Trump administration chose to cut taxes and mm-hmm. has effectively doubled our deficit in the last year. And I won't go into all the economic effects that are knock-on mm-hmm. effects from that. But I think Democrats recognize that the role of government is to provide a market and an environment in which people can be successful. And you can't be successful when you're making the minimum wage, your kids aren't in good schools, you don't have good roads to drive on, you can't rely on your infrastructure, you can't get to work. These are all things that Democrats want to provide for people. And cutting corporate taxes is not the way that we do that.
Yeah. You know, you and I have some things we think alike and some we don't. But, I mean, we had Bernie Sanders talking about a federal jobs guarantee. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not like providing, you know, this playing field where everybody can succeed. It was like he was asked directly by Andrew Yang, so you're going to, you know, solve for all these jobs that are lost to automation by giving a federal, you know, a guaranteed job? And he said, damn right I am. That was his comment.
Yeah, and I don't know enough about his plan to really comment
well,
on
and
how.
And I honestly don't either, but I'm just, when I was listening to it, I was just like, I can't reconcile how they talk like this and think that it's going to be good for the American
but
economy.
Emily's the first honest Democrat about this issue, right? She listened to your laundry list and she mm-hmm. said, look, we're not going to be able to do all of those things,
yeah.
right? That's the first time, because yeah. honestly, if you listen to the Christmas tree list that the Democratic Party laid out on that stage the other night, it's a mess. And then when you see the next day when people are peppering Elizabeth Warren about questions about, I mean, you can only raise the tax on the rich so high,
yeah.
right, at some point.
Yeah.
And then you talk about a middle class tax increase is the part that the Democratic Party is yeah. running from, but they know that's who's got to pay for it.
Dan, I thought the line of the debate was Senator Klobuchar when she said to Elizabeth Warren, you know, the American people deserve to know where the invoice is going to be sent.
Yeah.
Do you remember when she said that? Because she was doing the same thing where she was saying, you know, full disclosure here, if you're going to talk about all these things, we have to also talk about the trade-off. Who's
well,
paying?
We have to be realistic, too. I mean, as soon as I think everyone knows that
Democrats
a Medicare
realistic, that's awesome.
Everyone knows that Medicare for All is going to be paid for with taxes. Mm-hmm. Now, if I pay those taxes to the government versus paying it to my private insurer, if the costs go down, that's a wash. I don't care where I'm paying it. A lot of people talk about, you know, getting rid of private insurance means losing your doctor, losing all these plans. A lot of people don't care. I don't have a normal doctor. Mm-hmm. I don't care who I go to as long as I can get care. And, you know, it's not like we're going to just decimate our medical system by changing who it is that's paying for it, especially if the organization that is managing the HMO or managing the actual insurance isn't putting a 40% profit on top of it. If we can manage these programs without having a profit incentive, it means that we can have lower costs of care for people. And yeah, your taxes might go up, but your actual cost for health care will go down.
Emily,
as soon as Elizabeth Warren says that, that's the clip that's on the air.
Yeah.
And so she can't, they're going to keep asking it, but
I'm just kind of thinking of, you've got, you know, President Trump and then whoever the Democrats put out, and I think the most competitive person against Donald Trump will be someone who has a public option mm-hmm. but not Medicare for All.
Yeah.
And yet they go to the Medicare for All. Not all of them, but a lot do. Did you all notice the lapel pin that Andrew Yang had?
Yeah.
I want to talk about that for a minute. Did you notice this, Dan?
No.
Okay, it said MATH, M-A-T-H. And it stands for Make America Think Harder. Hmm. And to me, that was the biggest takeaway of the debate, because I don't think these candidates are thinking hard enough about what their policies mean.
Yeah.
How we pay for them, how they affect free enterprise.
I would argue that
how we benefit from them. In other words, their goals are great, but you got to think about, take like the wealth tax. They talk about a wealth tax. That scares capital out of a country. You know, it stops investors from coming in. And that's why Andrew Yang pointed out that in many countries it's been repealed, because mm-hmm. it had all these unintended consequences. So it's easy to say things, but they you have to think harder to know what it means.
I think you have to also realize it's difficult when you have these really big systemic ideas. It's hard to explain them in a way that is accessible in a 30-second snippet.
When 12 people are up there.
Which is my most frustrating takeaway from the debates is I want 5 people on stage and I want them to have a good amount of time to actually delve into how they're going to accomplish these things. Because I agree, a lot of people's takeaway is how. How are these things going
Does
to happen?
Does anyone know when we're going to get a smaller debate field?
Oh, well, what I mean, we'll see who qualifies for the next one. I think that a lot of the people who qualified for this debate also qualified for November. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to see if it starts to narrow. But I know the DNC is going to have monthly debates, and then it's going to start to be weekly in January or February. I don't remember exactly.
Delightful.
So it's going to be right before primaries start up. It'll be more frequent.
Love it.
Yeah. Well, there will be a natural thinning because they can't afford to keep going if they're not getting traction.
Yep.
I'm Natalie Gochner. I'm with Emily Hayes and Dan McKay. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Dan McKay on the right.
Emily Hayes on the left.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. Want to talk about Syria, one more big international and national issue for us. We have President Trump pulling out from Syria and then this incredible human carnage that has happened since. I guess there's some ethnic cleansing going on.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a bunch of ISIS fighters have been let loose.
Sure.
That were imprisoned.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Dan, what is the mindset of the Republican Party? I mean, even watching Lindsey Graham go after the president, I'm like, finally.
Yeah. In typical President Trump fashion, he has the plane taking off before making the run, make sure the runway's clear and make sure air traffic control mm-hmm. knows that he is ready to depart. He just does it, right? Mm-hmm. And he does it in
a phone call.
Very unconventional way, right? Mm-hmm. Does it a phone call. Mm-hmm. He presents a national military standpoint on a phone call with Turkey. I mean, it was really, I would argue, probably not the most refined approach to how you do it. That said, the explanation after why it's happened, it's pretty clear. President Trump, we talked about this. Mm-hmm. President Trump has campaigned consistently getting, out of Syria, getting out of some of these foreign conflicts that are both expensive and are ineffective generally in stabilizing the area. And so in some ways, it's President Trump living up to campaign promises. And I think for a lot of people, they're realizing, this is what a person does that lives up to a campaign promise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it living up to a campaign promise, though, to turn our backs on allies in a region where we already have created incredible instability? And while we pulled about 1,000 troops, I believe, that we've pulled out of Syria.
Can I just mention that this is interesting? In the news conference I heard today, the number was like 24, and Senator Romney was mentioning 50. And so I think there's been, this is to Dan's point about the clearing of the runway and stuff. I don't think we know.
Yeah.
I'm just going to throw that out there because it's not.
So it's questionable how many troops actually were stationed there. While we're sending troops into Saudi Arabia to apparently defend them against someone who's attacking Saudi Arabia. So are we going to pick our battles here and actually not go to war? Mm-hmm. Or are we going to go to the war in places where it is financially and economically beneficial for us to defend allies? Whereas we've pulled out of Turkey and allowed them now to commit a genocide, essentially, that they've been wanting to do for years. I mean, the relationship between Turkey and the Kurds goes back, basically a century before World War I, when we split up the Kurds into multiple countries, and it's created all of this, ethnic strife within these countries. And so I think it's really irresponsible to just pull out and say, do whatever you want, and then turn around and say, oh no, I'm gonna, put steel tariffs on you to punish you. And that's 0.04% of Turkey's economy. It's not exactly a stick to be dealing with here. So
yeah. Well, I have a feeling, I say this sometimes on this program, but we haven't heard the last of this. The president today was very adamant that no American has been killed or hurt and that we're, taking care of America first. If there's some human lives lost here, that would be really bad.
It would.
By the way, there are lives being lost. I just meant some of our soldiers.
Yeah, and
because of the way that this was handled.
The hard part of dealing with unraveling foreign entanglements that have questionable benefit is there are costs that are associated with them, right? And it is costs on both sides. And so I think history will have to look back on this and say, you know, was this the right thing to do? Mm-hmm. And I would argue that I would probably, were I president for a day, would probably do it differently. Mm-hmm. But I still think getting out of some of these foreign conflicts that are both expensive and at the end of the day, not accomplishing what we want to. I mean, we're on average in Afghanistan, for example, I mean, we are losing 2 U.S. soldiers, you know, a month. And it is just this ongoing project that
longest war in our nation's
mm-hmm. history, and it doesn't appear to see any daylight for an ending. And I'm concerned, and I think the American people are concerned as well. And I think that's why they look at President Trump and they'll look at the lives of foreign lost versus the lives of American lost, and how that should appropriately be done in the future. We are not the first nation to overextend itself internationally, and I doubt we will be the last.
Yeah. I need to segue this to local issues, and a good way to do
that's
that.
It's hard. There's a lot of local, a lot of like national stuff
going
on.
Yeah, big stuff. But the University of Utah was awarded the 2020 vice presidential debate. Oh, I'm thrilled about that.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Kingsbury Hall, what do you know about it?
I mean, I just know, I don't know a ton about it. I think it's really exciting. It's a good opportunity to put Utah on the map.
If I might have this wrong, but there's 3 presidential debates and 1 VP.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we were trying for all of them, and we got kind of the consolation prize, but we're one of only 4 places in the country.
It's very exciting.
I just want to know how I get tickets.
Yeah, same.
Honestly, that is going, I mean, you know, it's like political World Series for those of us who are nerds and love to follow this stuff.
Yep.
When it's in our home city and our flagship university.
Be awesome.
It's going to be kind of fun.
I'm really excited to see who, you know, who actually is on the stage.
I was thinking that last night.
Yep.
Who do you think it'll be?
I don't know.
Buttigieg is going to be one consideration.
I think he's definitely up there. I think Castro would also make a really great VP. I mean,
Fidel?
Yeah, Fidel.
Or
Raul?
Okay. No, our Castro.
Okay.
I think there's a lot of candidates in the field that would make great
some
vice
unlucky
presidential
last
candidates.
Name. In some ways.
There's some tough political names. That would be one of them, you know.
Yeah. Okay. We also got some fundraising numbers for the 4th Congressional District. You've got Ben McAdams serving. You know, he's done very well both in his popularity and his fundraising thing, but we're really talking about the Republicans, several names. Dan, give us some of the names and some of the numbers and what you saw in that. Saw is a lot of money.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, you know, Ben McAdams, I think, led. I was trying to remember. He was
about 500,000.
Yeah, it was just over a half million. Right behind him, at least as far as if we don't, you know, remove party, everything else, you just look at candidates. Right behind him was Senator Dan Hemmert. Mm-hmm. And I think right behind Senator
Hemmert. North of 400,000 for him,
and,
correct?
Yeah, it was north of 400,000 for him.
So
and
big.
There was a pretty big drop off. The other two ladies, Kathleen Anderson and Representative Kim Coleman, were below 200,000. And if you took away Kathleen's personal investment of like 125,000, she was below 100,000. And then, you know, there were, I'm trying to remember, and there's one candidate, Jay McFarlane, former KSL mm-hmm. News
everyone
radio
would
host.
Represent his, everyone would recognize his voice.
J-Mac, yeah. But, you know, J-Mac was interestingly in negative territory for how much money he's spent versus how much he's raised. But it's early,
so early.
Right?
They're
so early and there's a lot to be done.
But it shows that we're in for a ride.
It is going to be a roller coaster.
We also have Governor Huntsman back in town. I know there's a reception this week for him. It's going to be interesting to see how the former governor, former ambassador, reintroduces himself to this community.
Yeah.
And whether he feels like it's comfortable enough for him to choose to put his hat in the governor's race.
So you don't know if he's decided yet?
I'm certain he hasn't.
Certainly he hasn't.
And, and when I say that, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
But for me, he's got to collect information.
Yeah.
You know, and he's got to, you know, kind of feel it a little bit and
talk
to people. And I just don't think he's had time to do that.
Yeah.
And I think he'll find that Utah's very different than when he left.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think he'll find that there's no clear path to victory for him.
Yeah.
And that doesn't, it means he still has a really, really good shot. But are you willing to take a loss, Governor John? You know?
Do you think that rather than run for governor, he might decide to shoot for Senate or something
in 2022?
I think that
is a high, high likelihood.
Yeah.
I think he would make a great U.S. senator, and I think that it matches his profile better at this point. You know, an ambassador, then a U.S. senator, and all of his international experience.
Boy, Huntsman Romney would
been a governor.
Huntsman Romney
It'll be
would
Lee.
Be interesting.
Oh, you see what they go. I see what you're saying.
Like a Huntsman Romney Senate team representing Utah would be really, really interesting.
You know, what's also interesting is that when Governor Huntsman was our governor, Mike Lee was his legal counsel.
Yeah, that's right.
So they're close. I mean, they're
pals.
That's
right. Yeah, so I can't see. So it would take Senator Lee not running, I think, for something like that to happen.
Dan, I was up on Capitol Hill yesterday, and you know, I have business up there occasionally, and I was on my way up, and I'm just like, good heavens, something's going on. Everybody's here. You know, they can't find a place to park. And then I remembered, oh, interim this week. What's going on Capitol Hill?
Well, first of all, it's now interim. It's quickly becoming interim week because, you know, we'll end up having a meeting on Monday or two, and then Tuesday is appropriations meeting. You know, there's that. And then on Wednesday is standing committee meetings, and then Thursday you're trying to, you know, wrap things up. And it's just amazing how long the legislative week is becoming. I'll just leave that there. If we run out of time, that could be my gripe.
Oh, I just was writing it down for mine.
Yeah. So we can both talk about it. So the big issue that we are spending a lot of time talking about is, you know, special session for tax reform and tax changes.
Is that if you can get consensus or close to consensus, is that what they'll do is get it before the session?
I think
for the general session.
I think the sentiment of leadership, especially on the House side, is get this over with. And let's move on and have a general session that isn't about this, right? The last general session was all about this.
I think that's very wise.
Yeah, and so having that in the background is very smart. The question is, can we find enough consensus around, you know, kind of target areas of things that can be done that will accomplish the needed goal? By all means, that will be very interesting to see how that works out.
Yeah. Emily, from the left, you know, you have the Republican Party that pretty much gets to decide what they want to do up on Capitol Hill. What are you looking for? What are you worried about in the tax reform world?
You know, I think what I'm worried most about is that it's going to be pushed through without the right level of public input and the right level of you know, stakeholders at the table.
Would a special session meet that standard if they'd release things in advance? Or what does it have to be for you?
You know, I think a special session, if it was done the right way, could be effective. I feel, and a lot of people feel like the process has just been a PR campaign at this point. And I think that just getting a lot more information, a lot more of the reasoning out there will help. And I think on both sides of the aisle, we realize we need tax reform. There's things that have to change. Our economy has changed. The way people have spent their money has changed.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yeah. I think as Democrats, we definitely want to make sure, you know, taxes on services, sales tax, those are the kinds of things that we are generally food tax. Those are the things that we generally aren't in favor of because it tends not to be progressive and doesn't take into account, you know, your socioeconomic status and your income level. But I think we recognize there needs to be changes. They need to be changes that are going to hold Utah values and accomplish things that are going to benefit us and provide stable funding for the programs that we need, you know, not just for the next couple years, but when do we want to deal with tax reform again? I'm guessing it's not going to be in the next, you know,
Dan,
sessions.
You'll know more about this, but I think the public is going to see a fairly significant tax cut. I think it'll be an income tax cut. I think that you'll see the full sales tax on food, but there'll be a credit for low-income families. And I think that you'll also see this motor fuel tax, sales tax on motor fuel, and some brief expansion on services.
We'll see.
That's good. We need to go to gripes. As we do that, we're so close to the mayor's race, so just want to flag the mail-out ballots are, I think, out.
Out.
Yep, right.
We're 21, 21 to, they have to be in the 21 to 14-day period before the election. With the Salt Lake City mayor's race so close, let's just make our predictions. I'm going to predict Erin Mendenhall.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you like the most?
Well, I just think that her city experience will shine, and I think the voters will reward her for that.
Huh, yeah.
Yeah, Emily.
You know, I think that it's too close to call. I think this election's going to be decided by a couple hundred votes.
Chicken. I'm going to call. I think it's going to be Senator Escamilla. It's going to be the future mayor. I'm just going to say it that way because Luz is a fantastic colleague. My gripe is, if I was going to say, we have a shifted gripe, and I'll use the Salt Lake County mayor's elections, I wish we had all of the voters in Utah should have the ability to choose between the two great candidates I think we have in the Salt Lake County mayor's election. I mean, you got two very qualified women who are hardworking, intelligent, yada, yada, yada. You know, you can say what you want about one policy or another, but I wish that the electorate all the time had the ability to choose between two great candidates.
And this caliber.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Emily.
I think my gripe for the week is I'm going to stick to municipal elections. You know, I my purview is Salt Lake County, and so my gripe is that people don't, there's not enough oxygen in the room for all of the other great municipal candidates running around the county.
Yeah, because all we do is talk about the Salt Lake City mayor's race.
And Salt Lake City, like you said, we have some amazing people running. It's always really fun to pay attention to, and I love living in Salt Lake City and getting to vote in this election. But, you know, we've got great people running in Taylorsville, West Valley, Murray, Sandy, Cottonwood Heights.
Only Salt Lake City.
Only Salt Lake City. So just want to give a shout out to all of the municipal candidates out there.
I'll do a gripe on the Inland Port. I was up in Ogden and a bunch of women speaking to them, and they just had so much misinformation about the port. And I just think we need to get on the right track where people have right information. I'm Natalie Gochner. I'm with Emily Hayes and Dan McKay. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening.